Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Public policy touches every aspect of our lives, whether it's the welfare system, education and health, infrastructure, taxation, justice, you name it, there's a public policy measure behind every aspect of the operation of government. Well, of course, public policy is intrinsically intertwined with public politics. And there are increasing concerns about short-term, knee-jerk, populist policy-making on the run by politicians seeking a bump in the polls or to wrong-foot their opponent. The fractious tension between politics and policy often leaves us with short-term, poorly implemented solutions that not only don't work, they generate cynicism in the electorate. Well, an eminent panel of experts met recently in Canberra for the Peter Carmel Forum on Public Policy, hosted by the Academy of Social Sciences. The question being addressed was this: can good policy rescue politics? They discussed how to revive good government and whether the right policies built on well-researched evidence could return us to strong and visionary government. One of the panellists at the forum was former Liberal leader and leading economist Dr. John Hewson.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Nice to catch up again.
Yes, indeed. Were you surprised to see the themes of Brexit and the America First policies of Donald Trump and now focusing on Australian citizenship? Were you surprised to see these themes emerging from our current political milieu?
Well, I think the political system's been in decline in most countries for quite some time, in the sense that a significant and increasing percentage, let's say, of the voters, the voting public, feel disenfranchised from the process, disillusioned. They no longer trust or believe in politicians and the political process to deliver the sort of outcomes that they want in their day-to-day lives. And this has progressively manifested itself. The Brexit vote, of course, an anti-London vote in many ways, anti-Europe vote. The Trump phenomenon is a lot of people just want change. Sick and tired of the system, but he tapped a particular mood of low to middle income white males initially that hadn't seen an increase in their standard of living for a couple of decades. You're seeing it in Australia, you know, with one in three people at the last federal election voting for a minor party on independent. You know, this is just a clear message to the major parties, the traditional, if you like, political elite, that people have just lost faith.
So their KPI is to maintain or gain power, and so to get that back, they feel as though they need to chase that agenda, and it becomes a self-defeating proposition.
That's right. I mean, you're seeing now these sort of Trump-like policies implemented in Australia. And I noticed there was a headline, I think, on the Telegraph this week, a photograph of it, an image, if you like, of Turnbull with a Trump hairstyle, on the basis that he'd made these statements about 457 visas, but not that he changed the system. It needed changing. It had been abused. But he did it in a way that he just talked about very nationalist sentiments and putting Australia first and saving Australian jobs and, you know, all the powerful rhetoric. When basically 457 visas are, you know, are less than 1% of their workforce, they're not that significant an issue. Sure, it needs to be fixed.
And the timing of it seemed very much to be a response to what's happening within his own party, your former party, my former party for that matter. Is the leadership issue driving the agenda at the moment?
Well, to some extent, you know, there's always, as you know, there's always, we say this, most members of parliament have got their leadership baton in their knapsack, you know, they bring it out in the whatever chance they can. There's that element there all the time. But look, I think what's happened at the federal level is that Turnbull has done two things. One, he failed to match the expectations with which he won the leadership and had enormous initial electoral support. So he's seen the fastest and most significant collapse in personal poll standing probably in our history. At the same time, you know, he's got a disgruntled leader that he replaced who some people think, not necessarily that they should come back, but he stands for a different set of values than Malcolm. And in those circumstances, you know, they've been stirring the pot. And when you get people like Christensen calling a press conference after a party room and saying, well, I rolled the government, you know, that's not a good management look.
Well, everybody else has some advice for Tony Abbott. What's yours?
Well, look, Tony used to work for me, as you know. And I think, you know, I argued at the start of the election campaign, actually publicly, that Abbott should be given a job. he should have been given the job, I think, of taking on Shorten and making Shorten's life difficult, so he couldn't have run these scare campaigns that he managed to get away with. But, I mean, if you're picking your team on merit and experience and capacity, then you say Abbott's got to be part of that team because he's an experienced minister. He's been around the political process for quite some time. I don't think he's necessarily going to undermine or leak from cabinet. I don't think he's a rudd in that sense. He comes out publicly and says what he thinks. He doesn't sort of feed it out to journalists behind the scenes as Rudd did, and, you know, sort of there are leaks and all these sort of innuendo and stories are emerging. But I think he should be a member of the team. But I think it comes back to Turnbull's got to manage this group. You can't let them run amok. I mean, the Nats have been able to run off and do all sorts of policies that, you know, that don't make much sense. Ultra-supercritical coal-fired power stations in Australia.
Yes.
When they can't burn Australian coal, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Now we want to decentralise all government departments to their particular regional seats. I mean, this needs to be controlled. It can't be left to drift.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've almost fallen into the same trap as we started out to critique, which is that as two media commentators, here we are talking about politics. So let's get back to policy. You're an economist who threw his lot in with, at the time, Phil Lynch as Federal Treasurer and wanted to see good public policy becoming good public politics. So imagine you're putting the budget together it's well been put together now, but where do you think they need to go on issues, for instance, like this crazy superannuation thing where people would be, it's proposed by some in the cabinet, allowed to draw down on their super in order to pre-purchase houses, something that economists say would really just drive up the short-term price of houses?
Well, that's right. I mean, just to go back to Phil Lynch, I joined his staff in the middle 70s on the expectation that good policy would be good politics with a relatively short lag. I've got to say today it's short-term politics, it's stopping sensible policy development and debate, and the whole process has been politicised, not only those who are going into Parliament, how they're getting there, what they're doing when they get there, but the bureaucracy's been politicised, the media's been politicised, and so it's very difficult to have a rational policy debate about anything. One side of, it's a very sort of negative opportunistic game these days, but one side proposes on the other side immediately.
And your point is that the media itself is now part of that game.
Well, some of the media see themselves as players in the game. They see themselves as instrumental in creating and carrying through leadership events and so on. To go to your specific case, look, there are a lot of... Let's take housing affordability as a particular issue. Okay, we know that the problem is that the demand for housing has outstripped the supply of housing for quite some time, which has bid up the price. So why has demand been so strong? Well, part of it's been an investor demand. Part of that's been because people have got tax concessions to be investors. That's negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions. Part of it's that they've been able to borrow in their superannuation funds and buy property as an investment. So there's and part of it's been foreign. So there's your excess demand in those sort of three areas, I would think. On the supply side, we've had all the restrictions of the release of land, the approval processes, some state and local government taxes and charges, all these elements that have restricted supply. So if you want an answer to the question, you've got to work on all those fronts. You've got to work with an integrated, holistic response to the issue. There's no silver bullet anymore. There's no magic solution. This has been drifting for decades. I actually talked about housing prices emerging in the 80s.
Yes.
It's just been allowed to drift to the point now where a whole generation of younger people aren't able to buy a house.
If only they'd listened to you, John Hewson, you see.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that people have seen this issue coming for quite some time.
They have. So is there something, do you think there is something in the budget coming up that will start to address the problem?
Well, I hope so, and I think that they've got to swallow their pride a bit here, because the Labor Party has got out in front again this week in terms of detailing some of the elements of an effective overall response to the issue. I think they've got to take the good ones of those, to be honest, as part of a package, and I think you do need to do things about negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions and foreign purchases and vacant houses and apartments and use of superannuation money and so on. These are issues that can be dealt with, and should be dealt with as part of a holistic package. But we shouldn't have unreal expectations. It's not going to turn it around quickly. It is going to take years to get to this problem. Yeah. It will take years to trade out of it.
And we, as the we the people, as they say in the United States, but we the electors, we ought to be able to say to them, look, we don't actually expect a silver bullet, but we do want you to take steps based on evidence, that is good policy, that will turn the direction so that we'll see a medium-term change, but we're not going to be stupid enough to let, you know, some opposition leader tell us that it can be fixed overnight just because he wants to get into the lodge.
Now, I think that Turnbull's most effective response now and dealing with the leadership issue at the same time is to lead, and that is to get out in front on a couple of these issues, delineate his policy position, and go out and argue it to try and take the community to the community with him. And I think if he does that on key issues, the electorate will actually cut in quite a lot of slack because they're looking for good government. Go back to our initial discussion.
Yes.
They're dissatisfied with the establishment, with the institutional structure, with politics.
Yes.
They want to see governments govern. They want to see them addressing issues that matter to people in their day-to-day lives. And as soon as somebody stands up and actually visibly is doing that and trying to do that, then I think they'll get electoral support and we'll reverse some of these very short-term populist trends that you're seeing, as you say, in the United States or now here in this country.
Very good. John Hewson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Stephen. Nice pleasure, as usual.